Hello and welcome again to another edition of Lost in Science. This is half an hour of science on your radio across the nation on the Community Radio Network. My name is Stu, and on the show with me this week I have Chris.
Hello Stu, how are you?
I'm well. Now, I don't know about you, Chris, but where I am, we're having elections.
Oh, where are you?
I'm in Stonington.
Oh, yeah, everyone's having council elections, but...
Council elections.
Do they count?
There are people who say we've got too many tiers of government, but elections are part of democracy and all that.
They are. And, you know, some of them, I suppose, do less useful things than others. I'm looking at you, US presidential race. And that's actually something that I've been thinking about, Stu. I'm going to push the definition of science on this week's show by looking at some political science. Essentially, I got wondering about the US election. That's what started me off. How everyone's saying it seems really close this year, the race between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And the last two US presidential elections have also been rather close. Close enough that they can cause great upheaval, I suppose.
Yeah.
So it got me thinking, how are they so close? You know, when we're constantly being told that the public is so polarized, how does it happen to land 50-50, pretty much? And is there a mathematical reason for this, is what I was wondering. So I set out to find out. I did speak to an expert. I spoke to Dr. Adrian Beaumont, who is a mathematician and cephologist, it's an election expert, from The Conversation. And yeah, trying to get some insight into what's really going on.
Now, I'm talking about something completely different. And I know Catriona was talking about small little moons on the show last week, trapped moons that come into the Earth's orbit and get stuck there for a little while and then wander off again. I'm going to look at the OG moon, the one that we have usually that orbits the Earth. But I'm also going to look at some other moony news from other parts of the solar system as well, because, you know, the amount of stuff that's going on in space is quite astounding, and there's always more to find out. So moons everywhere. There's a lot of moon news.
Excellent.
So, so stay tuned for that later in the show.
Science, novel and innovative concepts occasionally arise from sudden left-field inspiration.
Nothing shocks me. I'm a scientist.
But I'd rather be remembered for my own small contributions to science.
As a scientist, I don't want to prejudice my experiment. I'll let you know in the morning.
I am a scientist!
I think they're scientists.
I bring scientists. You bring a rock star.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you are listening to Lost in Science.
All right, yes, you are listening to Lost in Science. My name is Chris, and as I said, I've been pondering the closeness of elections. Now, Stu, we did discuss the US presidential election, oh, and your local council elections, but obviously the presidential election is one of the big ones that people watch around the world. But look, there are other ones as well, and it has seemed like, I don't know, like there have been some hung parliaments in systems like Australia and the UK in recent years as well. And also you've had some, you know, interesting results coming out of Europe lately as well. And it did get me wondering if there was a reason why these elections seem to be so close. Yeah, look, I wanted to get to the bottom of this, and I tried looking up, you know, various things about the, say, the mathematics of political science, shall we say, and how elections work. And there's a number of different theories out there, I suppose, and nothing that could that particularly satisfied what I was looking for, that seemed to be like a broadly kind of applicable theory. There's this thing that's, I think it's sometimes called Divergence Law, and it's kind of the idea that two parties that if they are opposing to trying to win the vote, they'll eventually kind of meet in the middle.
Right.
And with kind of centrist policies. But I think that's a bit counter to what we're seeing in a lot of jurisdictions as well. And again, particularly looking at the US, where you have such a some such polarized views, that it doesn't really seem to be the phenomenon that's going on there.
I did see a bit of the vice presidential debate, and they said they agreed on a lot of things, but if you look at their actual policies, they're not close to each other policy wise. They're quite oppositional in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that principle may, depending if you look a certain way, may apply in some other places. Like I think some, certain Australian elections, you do find that, but it can be hard to discern these things. And basically, confirmation bias, you kind of find what you're looking for. And so that's what I always wanted to start with, was am I just suffering from confirmation bias here? So I thought I'd speak to an expert. And as I said in the introduction, I contacted Adrian Beaumont, who is a mathematician and statistician, does the election analysis for The Conversation. Highly recommend checking out his articles on there. And so, yeah, I asked him the question, now, why are elections so close? And you know what he told me?
What did he tell you, Chris?
They're not that close.
Ah.
So let's go backwards. The US, for instance, we're talking about. So yes, the last two elections, presidential elections, have been quite close.
Mm.
as we said, in 2016 you had the Electoral College and the popular vote went in different directions. You had Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, Trump won the Electoral College. So basically it was close enough that was a split kind of there. And again, in 2020, it was obviously close enough that there was riots and accusations of fraud. But, and you know, possibly this next election may be close, but we don't actually know because it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
So it's a bit early to say that. And the previous election prior to 2016 was 2012, and Obama won that one easily. And there have been other not so close elections in the recent history.
I do remember one, and I can't remember how long ago it was. I think was it a George W. Bush election where they were arguing about hanging chads?
Yeah, that was the Al Gore and George W. Bush in 2000. And that was a particularly close one, I think, as well. But the point is that they're not all that close. And if you look at their Congress, the equivalent of our Parliament, you know, the Democrats won quite easily in 2018. Democrats won quite easily in 2018. The Republicans won in 2014 midterms. So it wasn't, you know, that close across the board. If we think about, if we go around the world, you know, the UK has had hung parliaments in 2010 and 2017. But this year they had a big landslide to Labour. In 2019, they had a big landslide to the Conservatives. And they haven't had many hung parliaments in their history prior to that. Looking at Australia, there was, we have a similar kind of system across many states. There was a hung parliament in 2023 in New South Wales. But apparently that was the first in Australia since basically Queensland in 2015. And that's out of all the states around. And you had things like, you know, Mark McGowan in WA winning by large amounts. Tasmania is a bit different, though. Tasmania has had more hung parliaments. They had one, I think, this year, but they have had a lot of other kind of majority ones. But they're a bit different because they use a proportional voting system. And certainly your kind of split votes are a lot more common in a proportional system than in sort of the single member electorate type of systems that we have in many other states in Australia that you're looking at basically in things like the UK and in the US. But certainly when you have a proportional system like Tasmania or like many of the countries in Europe, you do kind of get these more divided votes simply because it's a proportional thing and you're getting, I guess, a wider view of who should be in power. So it really depends on where you are, and it's not consistent across time that there is this trend towards close elections. It is one of these, it does seem to be largely a confirmation bias thing.
And I mean, I guess the other thing about the US presidential election too is that, like you were saying, the Congress is a separate electoral process to the presidential election. And yes, the president has a number of powers that's granted to the president, but ultimately everything has to go through the Congress anyway, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's almost balanced out that, oh, you might get these really close races in the election, but the Congress is throwing it all up in the air again anyway, so it doesn't necessarily mean a great deal because it's only one person that you're voting for, really.
Yeah, and look, as I said, I tried to look and see if there have been different models on this. Another theory that I encountered was not the idea that parties necessarily will move towards the centre, but that voters may migrate from one party to another depending on who's in power. So that if, say, there's a Republican president, the Democrats will do well in Congress at the next midterms, etc., etc. But, you know, I'm not sure that there's a definite trend that occurs, or again, it is just this kind of nice idea. It doesn't necessarily bear out in the reality.
There's not actually a clear pattern that really happens.
Yeah, that's right. Interesting. One of the interesting facts that I did find, though, when I started looking into this, when you're looking at the history of US elections, the closest on record was in 1960, where JFK beat Richard Nixon by only a few thousand votes in Illinois, I think it was. And of course now JFK is regarded as one of their great presidents. Whereas one of the biggest winning margins in history, not the biggest winning margin, but one of the biggest, I think the second biggest winning margin, was actually Richard Nixon again in 1972. And that didn't work out so well.
Yeah, that's it's very interesting, the statistics behind it all, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think it also shows that, you know, it's similar, it's maybe the kind of system that they have there, in particular with their complicated primary system, their electoral college, this sort of thing, doesn't necessarily guarantee you're going to get the best leader winning. The way that the chosen is not necessarily going to be the best way. But anyway, so we are still interested in what is going to happen this year. I did ask Adrian Beaumont, you know, if we can forecast. You know, he has a background in mathematical forecasting, whether we can actually predict who's going to win. And essentially, all we can really do is just look at the polls. I mean, the polls, as you said, are not always accurate. They kind of have a margin of error, so you do have to take that into account when you're looking at these things. But essentially, you know, they are aiming to try and represent what is the views of the public. And so they're the best data that we have at any point in time. Apparently, the only other thing that is a big factor is the state of the economy. That's the other thing to keep an eye on. If the economy is good, then the incumbent stands a better chance of winning, of course, and vice versa. But essentially, because the polls are so close, I think in this particular case, we are just going to have to wait until the day and see what happens, and hope that it's not as controversial, perhaps, as it has been in the last few years.
Yeah, well, hopefully there's no further insurrection attempts, but you can always do what I do and have a quick look at the bookies' odds just before the election. It's often a pretty good indicator of which way it's going to go too.
We'll be right back. I think we're lost.
We're not lost.
Not even any short-range radio signals yet?
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
Science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Of course, that's mostly on the theoretical side.
What so far?
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
Now, when I was a kid, Chris, I used to draw really cool drawings of cool stuff, like spaceships and robots and dinosaurs. And I think mostly because I watched movies and cartoons about spaceships and robots and dinosaurs, I suspect is the reason.
Oh, because they're cool as well.
Because, yeah, they're cool, of course, yeah. But when I drew dinosaurs, and I don't know if you did used to draw dinosaurs as a kid, I think lots of kids do, but I would often put them in a scene including a volcano erupting.
Yeah, that's traditional with their dinosaur representations. And I've,
yeah,
having young children, I can see that is still the standard way of depicting dinosaur times.
And it's cool to draw erupting volcanoes. I mean, that's a cool thing to draw. It's fun. But again, I was, you know, innocently plagiarizing the art that I'd seen where dinosaurs are traditionally posed in front of erupting volcanoes.
Well, it was a theory for a while that, you know, volcanoes were, I mean, and still actually is a theory in some quarters that volcanoes were responsible for the extinction of the dinosaurs.
Interesting. I was actually saw this when I was looking around this stuff. There is a theory that the volcanic activity may have caused a mass extinction before the dinosaurs, which cleared the path for them to become the dominant life forms. So maybe there is something in that, but basically the idea that there was a whole lot more volcanic activity when dinosaurs were around, they were around for a really long time, for one thing. So you're talking, you know, 165 to 180 million years. There was probably periods where there was more volcanoes and periods when there was less, and it's probably up and down. It probably was not much different on average than what it is now. But there is some new research which has suggested there may have been a lot more volcanic activity during the time of the dinosaurs, very nearby, but not on Earth.
Oh, well, that wouldn't affect the dinosaurs then, would it?
No. But tiny glass beads collected by the Chinese lunar mission to the far side of the moon, which were brought back in 2020, and they're obviously still being analysed. They took a lot of samples. Suggests that active volcanoes may have been on the moon as recently as 120 million years ago. So
that's hard to believe.
Well, through the period when dinosaurs were active on Earth. So the tiny glass beads is just one bit of evidence, and they need to do more analysis. But the dating that they've put on them is that, yeah, there were probably still active volcanoes on the moon when the dinosaurs were around. So I'm just thinking maybe I should have done pictures of nighttime scenes with volcanoes on the moon.
Well, the moon does
behind
have
the dinosaurs.
The moon does have a lot of craters, just saying. But it is hard to believe that there was so kind of molten in the interior of the moon that recently. You would have thought something that small would have cooled down.
Well, I mean, this is why it's such a surprising find, I suppose, that they are sort of, it's out of whack with the clock, with the timelines they were expecting, basically. Volcanic activity is interesting for other reasons, including that it creates specific igneous rock formations, which have obviously been studied extensively on Earth. We know a lot about, you know, the kinds of rocks and things that volcanic activity can cause. Now, on the moon, they have discovered old lava flows on the moon. So they do know there was definitely volcanic activity. Just the time period is what's surprising about this new discovery. But just recently, they discovered a cave close to the surface of the moon, which is formed from the collapse of a lava tube. So lava tubes form when lava cools on the surface and solidifies, and the lava keeps flowing underneath that surface, and then if it's, you know, basically if it's flowing downhill, it leaves a tube behind it where the molten lava all sort of flows out at the other end. So what they found is a structure. It's about 40 meters by 120 meters just below the surface of the moon.
Wow.
And they've discovered this by analyzing radar data from the NASA Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. And based on this and based on other, you know, data that they've collected, they estimated there may be hundreds of these kind of lava tube caves on the moon, just below the surface. Which, you know, I mean, the ideas of, oh, well, okay, they could provide short-term shelter for visiting astronauts and they could potentially use them as the beginnings of permanent habitable structures on the moon, and they might even contain frozen water if they're protected enough from the sun and all these sorts of things. But I guess in a more pragmatic way, the interior of these caves could contain rocks and minerals and materials that can be studied to show what the early life of the moon was like and whether volcanic activity was actually continuing until 120 million years ago. They've got lots of samples from the surface of the moon, but this stuff just underneath could show them a lot more about what it would have been like back in time on the moon. Now, in other moony news, and the detection of different materials on celestial bodies is always very interesting. So the JW Space Telescope has detected carbon dioxide and hydrogen peroxide on the surface of Charon, which is Pluto's biggest moon. So Charon, Charon's about half the size of Pluto. Mm. And, you know, to call it, it's almost an argument which one's the moon, because they're kind of orbiting each other.
Yeah.
But they're orbiting each other almost. The center of the orbit is outside of Pluto.
So you'd expect Pluto and its moon to be fairly similar then, if they're out that far and they're that similar in size and they're orbiting each other. Surely you'd expect them to be fairly similar, wouldn't you?
Well, possibly, but I guess it depends what materials they are formed from to begin with, which may have an impact on the chemistry and all those sorts of things. But they already knew that there was water on Charon. The surface is covered in ice. And then they found there's carbon dioxide. They think the carbon dioxide is erupting from below the surface of Charon and coming up from inside the moon.
So volcanic activity.
Well, possibly, but it might just, there's other processes that aren't volcanic activity, which obviously involves molten rocks and lava, which I don't think it's big enough to.
But yeah, molten carbon dioxide is still molten, even if it's,
Yeah, I guess. I mean, maybe that does count as volcanic activity. I'd have to speak to a volcanologist, I suppose. But the hydrogen peroxide, they think, is actually just being formed when there's ice on the surface and it's getting bombarded by radiation. And it changes it to hydrogen peroxide. It pings off an oxygen and it turns it to hydrogen peroxide. So it's a chemical process, but there's nothing. It's radiation transforming the chemical, not a life process or anything like that. Because there's a lot of conditions on Charon that are not hospitable to life, including the fact that it's really, really cold and far, far away from the sun. There's no liquid water on Charon, so the idea that there could be any life there is probably pretty remote.
But it would have blonde hair, is what you're saying.
possibly. If it got to the point of evolving hair, maybe it have blonde cilia if it's single-celled organisms. Chemically interesting as that is, it's not a strong candidate for hosting life in the solar system, but another moon is a strong candidate for potentially supporting life. And that's the moon of Europa, which is the fourth largest moon orbiting Jupiter. Now, Europa is about the size of our moon. They're similar in size. And we know that Europa has a liquid ocean. There is liquid water on Europa. It also has an atmosphere containing oxygen. Now, both of those things suggest that it may be able to support some kind of life form, even if it's just single-celled organisms, which is the most likely thing that we would find if we went looking for life.
Yeah. I think I think Enceladus, the moon of Saturn, one of the moons of Saturn, is in a similar kind of condition. Position that's got like liquid water and has been speculated as being a possible, you know, home of life.
Yeah, and so, you know, you look for these basic things, but then there's a whole lot of other things they've got to consider. So they think that the ocean on Europa is interacting with the geology, so the actual rocks underneath interacting and releasing soluble chemicals into the ocean. So there's some form of salts dissolved in that ocean. Now, the issue with that is if it's too salty, it's very difficult for life to establish, because basically you need to have, well, as far as we know, you need to contain water within the cells that are alive. If you get something that's too salty, all the water gets sucked out of them. So that's one issue. Also, there seems to be a lot less oxygen in the atmosphere of Europa than they first thought. So that's another issue which might be a problem. But, you know, if you think about early life on Earth didn't actually rely on oxygen to the extent that life does now. So, you know, there's a lot of question marks over this. But the good news is NASA have just had approval to launch a spacecraft to Europa in October, which is this year, which is this month, aiming to find out how likely it is that the moon could support any life forms. So this is a, you know, it's a long way off before we actually get any data from this, because it's going to take the Europa Clipper 6 years to get to its destination. But it's planned to orbit Jupiter every 3 weeks, and it will undertake flybys of Europa each time, some as close as 25 kilometers above the surface. It's going to be carrying cameras and measuring equipment, including ice-penetrating radar, and will be potentially able to map the entire surface of the moon as it does these flybys. So relatively soon, we're going to have a much better idea of whether or not the conditions are appropriate on Europa to support life. But again, as I say, this is life as we know it. We can compare the conditions to what we know places that life can exist that exist on Earth. But, you know, that doesn't rule out anything, really. There's possibilities that there could be life that we don't, that have completely different metabolisms and things. But it's got water, it's got some oxygen, it's got an ocean. All the life on Earth began in the ocean. So we'll find out if there's anyone home when they do a few flybys in 6 years' time. So stay tuned for that.
Can't wait.
And that is all we have time for this week on Lost in Science. Thank you for joining us in Getting Lost. If you have any questions or suggestions for the team, get in touch with us by email. We are lostinsci@gmail.com. You can send cheap tweets to us at lostinscience1 on Twitter, or you can find us on the ubiquitous Facebook. Lost in Science is recorded at the studios of 3CR in Melbourne on the land of the Kulin Nation, and is broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find a podcast version of the show on 3cr.org.au, or you can tune in the way you did this week when we return in our usual time slot to get
Lost in Science!
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.